It is 8:31, and we have with us live in the studios once again, John Parrish and Maria Tomchik, co-editors at Eat the Steak. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good
to
morning.
You.
Got lots to cover today, so I propose we just dive right in. The State of the Union address. We got to mention something about it because there's a lot of things that stem from topics that were brought up during that. So.
Yeah, no mission to Mars this year. I was sorry to miss that.
Oh yeah, I'd forgotten about that.
And so the parlor game is figuring out what out of this year's speech will become this year's mission to Mars, where it was, you know, kind of thrown out in the course of the State of the Union, but will be promptly forgotten afterwards. Social Security, very definitely not. That was much to the top of the list. My guess for what will be forgotten is the scoldings to Saudi Arabia and Egypt that they should become more democratic. I don't think we'll hear much about that in the future.
No, I don't think so either. But while we're on the topic of Social Security, let's talk about that a little
sure.
bit. George Bush has supposedly got a plan, although we haven't seen the details of it yet, that workers who are under the age of 50, I believe, or was it 55? I don't remember the actual cutoff age, would be able to contribute a portion of their meager payroll tax for Social Security to private accounts. Now, what he's not telling you, and what we're not going to hear from the people who are proponents of this plan of, you know, partial privatization of Social Security, is that it's based on other plans that have existed, that have been set up and exist in other countries around the world. And I noticed that, you know, if you're like me and you regularly scan the Wall Street Journal for interesting tidbits, I've noticed over the course of the last month or so, the Wall Street Journal has had several articles about, you know, the privatization of Social Security, and some of them actually talk about these other plans that have existed in other countries and that the Bush administration might base their privatization plan on. For example, Argentina and Bolivia have privatized their Social Security plans, their pension plans for retirees. And in both cases, they did it when they had government deficits, large budget deficits. And in both cases, the privatization of their privatization plans did not make any provision for paying current retirees, which the Bush administration plan he has not mentioned or not made any provision for so far. And in both cases, the privatization of their pension plans contributed to economic collapse in both of those countries. Argentina defaulted on its debt and is still in arrears on its debt payments, and currently bondholders, banks who own Argentinian government bonds, are looking at getting maybe 30 cents of on the dollar for their investment. And Argentina's been in big trouble with the World Bank and IMF ever since, and there's been major political upheavals there.
Yeah, although the IMF
Same
in the first
Bolivia.
Place was one of the institutions that was encouraging the privatization.
Yeah, that's true. But because of the privatization, it led to economic collapse, and the same in Bolivia. In fact, in the street protests in Bolivia that have brought down the former government, a lot of the people in the streets protesting were pensioners who weren't getting paid their benefits. Now, in other places, like in Chile, for example, the Bush administration and Bush administration supporters have pointed out that Chile has successfully privatized their government pension program and Social Security system. However, people who are starting to retire in Chile are finding that if they opted to go with the private accounts, that they're getting approximately a third to about half the amount of benefits that people who stayed with the government plan are getting. So that's been, in my opinion, a major disaster, because then the government has to step in, and if, you know, according to the Bush plan, if that were to happen here, the government would have to step in and fund the difference, and that would lead to an even bigger problem than we're looking at come 2042, when we might need to raise payroll taxes a little bit to fund the difference. Now, in Britain, where they privatized their pension system, it was a magnet for fraud, and they've had these enormous scandals over people who have stolen money from folks funding their private accounts, et cetera, et cetera. And there are people there who are economic analysts and government advisors who look longingly at the U.S. Social Security system.
People who supported the privatization in the
right.
first place.
Yeah, a lot of those people supported the privatization in the first place in Britain. They look longingly at our Social Security system, and they ask, you know, why do you want to change it? Why would you ever want to change the system that you've got, particularly when the changes that need to be made are so minor? If you really think about it, when you look at the advice that investment managers give, you know, middle-class people for their personal savings, they say save 8 to 15% in order to boost your retirement. And you compare that to what gets taken out of everybody's paycheck for Social Security, it's 6.2%. I don't think anybody would complain if it went up to 8%, for example. Or if you look at Singapore, where they have private accounts, where the government has privatized their pension Social Security system, those folks pay 22% out of their payroll to fund their private accounts. Who's going to complain if our Social Security taxes go up a little bit from 6.2%, which is pretty meager, to maybe 8%? And that's only one possible solution. Other minor tweaks to the system might be a tiny tax on investment transactions. For example, when a rich guy sells his bonds or his stocks, you know, tax him 1% or 0.5% on his gains. You know, he makes $500 selling a bond. He pays $5 to the government to fund Social Security. Who would argue with that? I mean, except for really, really, really greedy people.
Well, you had pointed out to me before, and I can't remember if it was on this show or elsewhere, that there's currently a cap or a ceiling at like $89,000, $90,000 that once people make more,
right.
The money you make after that isn't
taxed at all for Social Security. It's the cap on wages. It's the Social Security cap on wages. Now, if they lifted that cap and said, okay, guys, you make a couple hundred thousand dollars a year, pay Social Security on all of it instead of just their first $90,000, that would close a big part of the hole, you know, at get rich. And another solution that's been suggested is, why do we send Social Security checks to people who make more than $100,000? You know, rich people who you know, have taxable income of millions of dollars every year in bonds and stock investments, they still get a Social Security check. Why? You know, there ought to be some kind of upper limit as to who you pay a Social Security check to. So there are all kinds of solutions out there for fixing the minor problem that Social Security is going to have, you know, 30, 40 years down the road. There are all kinds of solutions for helping to close that gap. Privatizing it is not the answer. Just going to be a major mess.
All right. Well, moving along, there was some focus in the papers this week about.
Wait, wasn't there also some other stuff we wanted to talk about in the State of the Union address, such
there
as
could be.
Bush's comments about Iran?
Yeah. Well, I wanted that segues also into Condoleezza Rice, which is where I think you were going, because she's currently on a trip of Europe, swing through Europe and the Middle East, trying to repair frayed alliances, particularly with France and Germany and some of those countries. She is been quoted in the papers today as saying that an attack upon Iran is absolutely not on the agenda. Talking about the possibility of a military strike to try and take out Iran's purported nuclear facilities. Now you can take her at her word or not. This is the same woman who sold us on weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. So, I think she says what the public needs. The Bush administration thinks the public needs to hear. But at the same time, Rice has very much been an impediment. The Bush administration has been an impediment to the efforts by Britain and France and Germany to try and negotiate with the Iranians and using economic incentives to try and get them to stall their nuclear development. This is something that the sort of bellicose pronouncements out of Washington, including the State of the Union address this week, have made those negotiations much more difficult. And this is one of the things that Rice will be talking about in private this week with the various foreign ministers, you know, Jack Straw, who she met with yesterday, and the German counterpart as well.
All right. I have to really briefly jump in and say that Alberto Gonzalez was confirmed this week, and both Murray and Cantwell.
As Attorney General?
Yeah.
Yes.
Murray and Cantwell voted no, so they every once in a while they vote correctly.
Yeah.
Well, it took some persuading to get Patty Murray to vote no, but yeah.
Yeah,
it
took
yeah.
a while.
Mm-hmm. Which is more than they did for Rice, but at least they voted no on Gonzalez.
All right. So, moving along then, that takes us to This Week in Iraq.
This Week in Iraq.
Yeah, the big news this week is the elections that happened over the past weekend. Now, the U.S. press has been trying to make it out as a big victory, and so is the Bush administration. Folks might remember how the press played up certain Republican senators during Bush's State of the Union address having dipped their index fingers in purple ink in solidarity with Iraqi voters. However, the news that hasn't gotten out is the fact that there were major problems with Iraq's vote. In the first place, there was the turnout question, how many people actually came out to vote. Immediately, you know, on the day of the elections, you had Iraqi Electoral Commission members saying that it was 72%. Now, how could they know when polls hadn't even closed yet? In fact, they ended up backtracking the next day and saying, well, we think it might be 60%. And then after that, they refused to say how many they thought actually turned out to vote, and still we're waiting. We're still waiting for some kind of estimate of what the actual turnout was, and those numbers haven't appeared yet, and it is making me wonder why. But there were other reports of problems too, and I just want to talk very briefly about them. There was poor turnout in the city of Mosul, which is the third largest city in Iraq. You had U.S. soldiers driving around empty streets with bullhorns trying to get people out of their houses to go to polls to vote. Polls didn't open at all in several places, in the towns of Latifia, Mahmoudia, Yusufia, even in Samarra. The polls did not open. Samarra, I believe one polling center opened late in the day.
That's a fairly sizable city, too.
Yeah, that's a large city as well. In the town of Baiji, in Ramadi, polls did not open inside the city itself. Two polls opened on the outskirts of the city, but because there was a travel ban, it was very, very difficult for anybody who wanted to vote to even get there. There was a mention that one person had voted in the town of Fallujah, even though there were five polling centers open.
One person?
Yeah, that was late. That was as of late in the day.
That means most of the poll workers didn't even vote.
That's right. Turnout was very low in Tikrit and several districts inside Baghdad, especially in the neighborhoods of Yarmouk, Al-Amariya, and Al-Adamiya, where poll workers did not even show up to open polls, probably because they were afraid of insurgents attacking. And those are areas of central and western Baghdad that are largely Sunni neighborhoods, but also very highly populated areas. Most of the video and photos taken of voters in long lines of voters in Baghdad were taken in southern Baghdad, which are largely Shiite areas. There were other problems as well. There was a shortage of ballots throughout large swaths of the country, particularly in northern Iraq, where Kurdish people waited for hours for ballots that never arrived. And so tens of thousands of people were unable to vote in northern Kurdish areas of the country, which is a major problem. They also ran short of ballots in the Shiite south as well, in the city of Basra, in Najaf, and in southern Baghdad, where those photos were taken of long lines of voters. Those were people not just waiting to get in to vote, but in some cases waiting for ballots to arrive. And in a lot of cases, ballots did not arrive in time for people to vote. So tens of thousands, at least, were unable to participate in the election. Now, because of the travel ban and the closed borders, a lot of Shiite pilgrims who had wanted to return early in the day from their trips to Saudi Arabia, to Mecca, were unable to enter the country to vote. So you've also got thousands of people who could not get back into the country to vote. Where Sunnis did turn out to vote in some portions of central Iraq, there weren't enough ballots for them in the first place. Tens of thousands were unable to vote in Kirkuk, for example, where about 40,000, and in the town of Hawija, just outside of Kirkuk, where about 40,000 people were turned away from the polls just in that one town alone for lack of ballots. Secular Shiites also complained that when they went to the polls in the southern part of the country, in places like Basra and Samarra in particular, they found poll workers were handing out leaflets and urging people to vote for the United Iraqi Alliance. That's Ayatollah Ali al-Sistani's party, that there were actually poll workers pushing people to vote for that party in particular, which is not legal under the Iraqi system. Election observers also noted that the Shiite United Iraqi Alliance got the majority of votes, even in the Sunni-dominated areas where a few people turned out to vote. That's highly suspicious. Now, all of this should not be any kind of surprise, because Muhammad Ali al-Sistani's party is the only one other than Ayat Alawi's party that's been able to actually do any kind of campaigning. And it's also a party who has members inside the current government. So there's a good bet that a lot of the poll workers are people who also belong to this party. So that might be a little bit suspicious and might be one of the reasons why it would have been good to have outside election observers rather than people employed by the current government or people who are just members of parties that were participating in the election itself. Now, what we can expect and what we've heard from the election returns so far is that Ali al-Sistani's party, the United Iraqi Alliance, has received 60% of the votes so far from the 10 provinces that have been counted. That doesn't include the northern provinces and the Kurdish areas, which will probably go heavily for the Kurdish alliance. But getting 2/3 of a majority means that they could be close to being able to form a government, a largely Shiite government, because the constitution, the interim constitution, says that you need a 2/3 majority to appoint a president and 2 vice presidents, and then they will form a government. So that's something to be thinking about. And also, members of the United Iraqi Alliance have said that their first goal is going to be pushing for an Islamic constitution. So anybody who was thinking it might be a secular government might be kidding themselves at this point. But I also want to talk, in addition to the elections, I want to talk really quickly about what's going on here in the U.S. as a response to that. Folks in the U.S. here want to know, when will the U.S. troops come home now that the elections are over? According to George Bush, it'll be when Iraqi troops are trained and ready to take over security. However, the Senate got a big shock this week to find out that George Bush, Condoleezza Rice, Donald Rumsfeld, and others have been stretching the truth when they talk about the numbers of trained troops in Iraq. They've been saying it's about 130,000. Well, Democratic Senator Joseph Biden, he's the senior Democrat on the Foreign Relations Committee, he thinks it's about 14,000, not 130,000. Anthony Cordesman talked to the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, and he is a highly respected defense analyst at the Center for Strategic International Studies. He's traveled to Iraq, and he thinks it's about 7,000 to 11,000 troops that are adequately trained. Who's right? You might ask that question. Who's telling the truth and who's not?
Who's right?
You shouldn't worry if you're confused, because you know the Pentagon is confused, too. General Richard Myers, chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, told the senators in the Foreign Relations Committee on Thursday that only about 40,000 Iraqi soldiers are adequately trained. That's a big difference from the 130,000 figure that other Pentagon folks are putting out there. Paul Wolfowitz, the number two man at the Pentagon, said that there's about a 40% dropout rate in Iraqi army units. So that 40,000 number may even be a high estimate. And then Donald Rumsfeld.
And many of those dropouts are then going over to the insurgents.
Yeah, possibly. And then Donald Rumsfeld rolled his eyes and said, well, who cares what the numbers are? What we should be focusing on is the improvements that we're making in the training program, which is weird, because you have George Bush saying, well, the numbers are important because when we get more numbers, we can bring our troops home. And then you have Donald Rumsfeld saying the numbers aren't important. That's a problem. So I just want to leave you with that thought.
I still have the image that you painted early on of the U.S., the occupying troops in armored vehicles rolling through towns on bullhorns telling people to come out and vote, and why they
could. In Mosul, yeah.
Yeah, and why they would think that would be effective. I mean,
yeah.
If that was happening in your hometown, would you be, like, encouraged to come out and vote?
Uh-huh.
Anyway, all right. Well, moving along a little closer to home, the DNC looks like it's going to have a new person in charge.
Yeah, Howard Dean is almost certainly in the election that's coming up this coming week going to be named the new chair of the DNC, the Democratic National Committee. And this is really a 180-degree turnabout from a couple of years ago when Dean was very much running as an outsider for his presidential campaign in 2003 and early 2004. What has happened is very simple. The groundswell of donors and activists that fueled both the Dean campaign and later the Kerry campaign has really changed the dynamic of how the Democratic Party is being run. In the 2000 campaign, Al Gore got about $50 million worth of small donations. That is, donations that didn't come from big corporations and so forth, just, you know, sort of mom and pop donations from Bill. For John Kerry, that number was up to $225 million, $90 million of which was over the internet. And that, you know, the sort of the move-on wing of the Democratic Party is really in the ascendancy right now. It's where the Democratic Party funding is coming from, and it's the major reason why Dean has moved from being very much the outsider, opposed by the Washington establishment. Suddenly now he's Mr. Insider. He is the establishment in Washington, D.C. And what that means is that core that's providing a lot of the money to the Democratic Party right now, and a lot of the activism, a lot of the grassroots strength, is much more progressive than the sort of centrist wing that was in the ascendancy during the Clinton years. And even though Dean himself is probably not nearly as liberal as his image during the presidential campaign would suggest, he ran terms in Vermont as governor were very much as a centrist governor.
And he was very fiscally conservative, and he made a lot of cuts in social programs.
Yes, he did. That being said, the Democratic Party right now is following the money, and regardless of whether that's a good idea in terms of building election coalitions or not, it's probably good news in terms of the grassroots being more actively involved in building a stronger grassroots Democratic Party that's probably going to be more progressive.
All right. Well, I guess we'll wait and see on that,
or at least have a more progressive image.
Yes.
Yeah. Reprint the brochures.
Which is nice because it leaves a little opening for those of us to say, well, live up to your rhetoric, okay?
Yeah. Or part of it. Uh-huh. All right. Well, and jump into this state. There was a court ruling this week in regards to the governor's race.
Yeah, it was just yesterday, in fact. Court in Wenatchee, the judge there made a major ruling in the case of Gregoire v. Rossi. And both sides got some of what they wanted. The Democrats did not succeed in having the entire case dismissed. They did not succeed in having the case moved to either the state Supreme Court or the state legislature. The Republicans won on that score. The Republicans did not win in terms of the participation of all the various county election officials, all of which had been co-defendants in the case. They are no longer co-defendants. That part of their lawsuit was thrown out. And the other part of the lawsuit that was thrown out was any possibility of a revote. We're not going to have a revote as Dino Rossi and the Republican Party has been campaigning for. What we're going to have instead is either the possibility that the election will be nullified or that it will be upheld. And if it's nullified, it will probably then be up to the state legislature to decide to have some sort of a special election. And in the meantime, the Lieutenant Governor Brad Owen would probably ascend and become the acting governor. But that's the possibility right now, that the election will be nullified or it won't be nullified, and the case is going to go to trial. The Republicans did get one other minor victory in the course of the ruling yesterday, in that it's not just fraud, it's not just the dead voters and the illegal voters that will have to be tallied in order to prove that there's a margin there that could affect the outcome of the election, which would seem almost certain given how narrow the election would be. But it's also erroneous votes that or erroneous tallies that could be counted as well. So the Democrats were trying to get that thrown out. So the Republicans actually may have a fairly good case for nullification. The question really is whether the implications of a nullification are going to outweigh the Republicans' case or not, and we'll just have to wait and see on it.
All right. And then finally, Christine Gregoire is pushing for a large bucket or a wheelbarrow full of money for biotech.
Yeah, and this is in a year. She's proposed a $350 million plan to fund biotech here in the state of Washington. Now, we've talked a lot on this show about how biotech is a bit of a boondoggle because the number of jobs it creates for the amount of money spent is not very efficient compared to perhaps other things like maybe rebuilding the Alaskan Way Viaduct or fixing our roads and bridges, et cetera.
Or paying for education.
Yeah, or paying for, you know, increasing teachers' salaries or hiring more teachers, for example. Now, she wants to spend that money on building research facilities, and we know exactly where it's going to go. A large chunk of it's going to go to build the new bioweapons facility at the UW. That's the plan, anyway. And this is in a year when the state government is struggling with an enormous budget deficit that's climbing towards $2 billion.
Yeah, it actually got bigger this week by about $150 million.
Yeah, because the state nullified its estate tax. The judge ruled that the state estate tax cannot be levied if it's separate from the federal tax. So now the state has to refund a bunch of money that it charged charged people for the estate tax. So just put another bigger, it just made that hole in the budget a lot bigger. And here Christine Gregoire, in a year when people are saying, look, you're going to be, if you make any further cuts to low-income health care in the state, you're going to just decimate it, and they may be trashing the basic health care plan. She wants to put $350 million towards a boondoggle. I think that's idiotic.
All right. Well, a few events to mention here quickly. One, today is the International Day of Solidarity with Leonard Peltier, and the Portland Leonard Peltier Support Group is having their yearly march and rally, which is starting at noontime.
That's in Tacoma, right?
Tacoma. You are correct, sir. Tacoma. Portland Avenue Park, which if you are going on I-5, take the Portland Avenue exit and head east, and apparently you will cross it. So that starts at noontime. Second thing is this coming Tuesday will be the first public meeting in regards to the Bioterra Lab that Maria just mentioned. That's Tuesday at 7 p.m. at the South Campus Center, room 316R. And then the final item is this coming Thursday, a couple of outstanding speakers are going to be in town. They're going to be Richard Grossman from POCLAD and Thomas Lindsay from the Community Environmental Legal Defense Fund, who I interviewed last week on this show at 7:30, are both going to be in town speaking at Trinity United Methodist Church about what people can do to challenge corporations. And they both have numerous success stories to bring to you.
So that's wonderful speakers. Absolutely great.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So that's 7 o'clock at Trinity United Methodist Church in Ballard, which is at 65th and 23rd.
Mm-hmm. Thursday night.
You are correct. All right. Talking once again with John Parrish and Maria Tomchick, co-editors at Eat the State, and tell people where they can find Eat the State.
Eat the State comes out every couple of weeks. It's a local, national, global newspaper in terms of what we cover. Largely volunteer. You can find it at places where you get free periodicals, bookstores, cafes, whatnot. You can also find us on the web, at least we hope so, at www.eatthestate.org. And if you have questions, comments, tips, drop us a line. Let us know.